This is Fresh Air. It may be easier than you think to wind up homeless. Losing a job lands some people on the streets. Some jobs just don't pay enough to cover rent. Some homeless people are working but live on the streets or in shelters. These are some of the things Elliot Lebo learned during his study of homeless women at shelters in a town just outside Washington, D.C. His new book is called Just Tell Them Who I Am. You may recognize Lebo as the author of a 1967 book called Tally's Corner, a study of life on a street corner in an African-American neighborhood. The book is still in print and still used in many college courses. After it was published, Lebo went to work at the National Institute of Mental Health and didn't write another book until now. He started this study after he learned he had cancer and was told he didn't have long to live.
When I first learned about cancer, it was pretty advanced. It had already metastasized. This was 1984. And I was given to believe that I had anywhere from maybe 6 months to 18 months life expectancy. And I decided I really didn't want to spend those last months in a government office. So I retired on disability. I had a lot of time on my hands, and I felt pretty good at the time. So I started doing some volunteer work at a nearby soup kitchen. That was just one night a week, and I kind of liked that. So I decided to do the same thing, become a volunteer also one night a week at a shelter for homeless women. Over the next couple of weeks, I found myself so drawn to the women, so awed by them, and enjoying myself with them so much, that I started going there 4 and 5 times a week. And after a few weeks, I decided I'll take notes. It's one of the things I was trained to do and one of the things I knew how to do. And even though I had no idea of where it might end up, I thought it might be a good way to structure my day and my time, too.
Since you are a middle-class professional, it was, I'm sure, assumed by the women that you had some money. Did you feel responsible for them? And did you try to buy them meals and drive them around, and do you know what I mean? I'm sure you felt in a really awkward spot, like you had so much more than they did, yet it wasn't your responsibility to provide for them.
I'm not sure that I felt awkward. I was I think maybe embarrassed is more accurate. It was embarrassing to be middle class, to have the kind of income I had and the kind of home I had, and to see people with none of these things and watch them in this struggle, a titanic struggle, really, to stay human and to gain just those minimal decencies of life and creature comforts that the rest of us just take for granted. It was really it was quite a sight to see. And it's also a little bit embarrassing to have so much when you're surrounded by other people who have so little.
Did they try to hit you up for anything?
Very few. I tried to, as a matter of fact, I was hoping that more of them would exploit me than they did.
And why exactly were you hoping that?
Well, I think, first of all, because of my own embarrassment, I would have felt better if I could have, if I was meeting more of their immediate needs without volunteering it myself. I didn't want this to be a donor-beggar relationship. I wanted our relationship to be one of, if I could manage it, to be one of mutual trust, to be close to friendship, as best as a middle-class man can be friends with a homeless woman. And I set up what I told them was a kind of revolving fund. And I routinely lent out $2, $5, $10, and sometimes $20 to the handful of people who would ask for it, and explained to them that I needed the money back, if only to keep that revolving fund going so I could lend it to other people.
Well, that's interesting. So you had set aside a certain amount of money, and it was up to them to replenish the kitty, right, so to speak.
Well, I said that I had set aside a certain amount. In fact, I hadn't. There was no fixed dollar limit.
Mm-hmm.
At any given time, I might have had as much as, I would say maybe at any given time, maybe $200 or $300 outstanding.
Mm-hmm.
To not many women, and many of them knew. Many of them knew that they could borrow money from me, but chose not to.
Hmm.
Maybe in the same way that many of them knew that they were eligible for one or another kind of welfare and chose not to take advantage of it.
How did you spend your days with the women when you weren't at the shelter? What did they do with their time? They didn't have to be anywhere.
Yeah, they sure didn't have to be anywhere. That was one of the great problems for many of the women, that they didn't have to be anywhere. It raised all kinds of existential questions for them. I remember one woman who put it quite eloquently. The worst time of day, she said, for her was 7 o'clock in the morning. I must explain that most of the shelters require all the women to be out on the street by 7 o'clock in the morning. You can't stay there after 7. The shelter remains closed until 7 o'clock that evening. So the women are on the street or on their jobs. Many of them work or job hunting or whatever it is they do. They're on the street in any event between 7 o'clock in the morning and 7 o'clock in the evening. And for one of the women, the moment that she stepped out of the shelter at 7 o'clock onto the street was the worst time of day, because that was the point at which she had to decide where to go and what to do and who to see. And it struck her repeatedly every day that she had no place to go, that nobody wanted her anywhere, that nobody expected her anywhere, that nobody cared what she did. And imagine facing that. I mean, that wasn't just an occasional thought. That was something that overwhelmed her, that sense of distance from the rest of it, from the rest of the world, the sense of being surplus, the sense of being ignored, the sense of being alienated so totally and so completely, was a daily experience, every day at 7 o'clock.
So where would she go?
Well, she might go to a coffee shop and spend some, or there were some government buildings there. She would go to a government lunchroom maybe and have breakfast, which she had breakfast at the shelter if she wanted it, but she might go there for coffee and a donut, kill some time till the library opened. The library opened at 9. She might go to do a personal business. Being homeless is hard work, and you may have to go to social services. You may have to go to a doctor. You have to go job hunting. There are a lot of things that many of them do, and that's not enough. One of the most difficult things, really, for many of the women, was killing time. How do you get from 7 in the morning till 7 in the evening when the shelters open up?
My guest is anthropologist Elliot Lebow. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Elliot Lebow, author of the new book, Tell Them Who I Am, The Lives of Homeless Women. You said that sometimes it was really remarkable to watch the women fix themselves up to go to work or to go hunt for a job.
Yes.
In the mornings.
Yes.
How would they do that?
It amazes me. One of the most surprising things was to see a woman get up in the morning, being homeless, and transform herself into what looked like a very ordinary middle-class woman who's off to a middle-class professional job. Some of the women, say, were saleswomen some of the better department stores, even, or a data entry clerk for IBM. Now, you've got to make a fairly good a presentation of yourself in order to get those jobs, in order to keep them. And to see these women organize themselves in such a way so that in the morning when they left the shelter, they would be presentable, not only for a very demanding boss, but for also a very demanding public in terms of the clientele of the establishment that she worked for. The women were doing some amazing things with a curling iron and some cosmetics, And with very few clothes, perhaps, but carefully using them, carefully matching and coordinating a skirt with a blouse in such a way that they were able to really make themselves indistinguishable from people who were, at least at the moment, much more successful than they had been.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you what might strike you as a strange question, but since you were a man, being the participant observer with a group of homeless women, did any women interpret your attentions as flirtatious?
Maybe so. I say maybe because a few times I was asked things like, if you weren't married, would you give me a run for my money? That was a difficult question to answer. Normally, I tried to avoid it, avoid a direct answer, because either yes or no would really be a misrepresentation. If I said yes to that question, I would give you a run for your money. I would probably not be telling the truth. If I said no, it would be a very hurtful thing to say, and gratuitously hurtful, and there'd be no point in saying no, to just hurt that other person for no reason whatever. And my usual response was a kind of avoidance response by saying, listen, I think you're very nice. I really do. I think you're a very nice person. And I usually meant it. Well, as a matter of fact, I meant it all the time when I said it. And that was usually enough. That seemed to satisfy them, and that question didn't come back again from the same woman.
You had explained you were doing a study?
Oh, yes. They all knew I was doing the study. And they all knew why I was there.
Did the women know that you had cancer?
Yes. They did know, and that was that was an important part of my relationship with them. They knew when I had to go. I used to, at that time, in the first few years of hanging out there, I used to go to Canada, to Quebec, to get a drug that wasn't available here in the States. I used to go every 3 months, and the women all knew I made those trips. And it was an easy way for us to start a conversation. They could always start a conversation with me if they wanted to. In a very ordinary way, by asking me how I was feeling, or by asking me about the treatment, or asking me about the drugs, or life expectancy, or anything like that. And that, in turn, enabled me to ask them the same kinds of questions about their health concerns and about their health problems. So it was a very real part of... I didn't go out of my way to make a big deal of it, but it was a very real part of our relationship, because it was still another... It was still another focus of that... Well, it was another issue that could become a focus of conversation and of a relationship.
And it meant that you weren't living this absolutely perfect life while they were living tragic ones. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I that is something that never got talked about, but I suspect that was true. It may well be that they felt more sorrow and pity for me than I felt embarrassment of my own riches.
Now that your book is finished, are you still going to the shelters?
I stopped. The shelter I spent most of my time at closes from April 1st to November 1st. I was not able to go there this past year. I've been having trouble, a little bit of trouble, side effects from drugs managing some stairs, and that's a three flights up. So I'm hoping to be able to return to the shelter when in November, when it opens up. If not, maybe I'll find another shelter or soup kitchen to go to. But I feel very attached to this particular one. I identify with it so closely after having spent several years there in such an intimate way that I'd really like to go back to the same one.
How's your health?
Pretty good. Very good until I go... it's terrific until I go to the doctor or until I go to the clinic or something like that.
Well, because of what they tell you or...
Yeah, well, yeah, the tests and the assessments that they do don't always correspond to how I feel. I usually feel an awful lot better than they're telling me I should feel.
Right. Well, they told you should have been dead a few years ago, actually.
Well, yeah, and most of the discomforts that I experience are not directly from the from tumors or the cancer itself, but rather side effects of the chemotherapy or some other drugs.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel very good.
Did you find yourself becoming angry in the years that you did this study? Angry at conditions that cause homelessness?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I'm angry at the system. I'm angry at the system for 2, 3, 4 basic failures. I'm angry at the system for creating so many poor people. I'm angry at the system which allows people to work year-round full-time and not be able to support themselves and their dependents. I'm angry at a system which puts the blame for being poor on poor people themselves and says, how dare you be poor, and we're going to force you back into the workforce by making available very low welfare payments. We're going to shame you into going back. We're going to dare you to go back. We're going to push you to go back into the workforce. When many of these people, even when they work, they can't support themselves. We have a system which can't put its citizens to work. We have millions and millions of people out there job hunting. And we're talking about forcing women, let's say, on AFDC, forcing them into job market, too.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
Elliot Leibo is the author of Tell Them Who I Am, The Lives of Homeless Women. This is Fresh Air.